Being therefore justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Through Him we have access into this grace wherein we now stand, and we rejoice in hope of sharing the glory of God, and we also rejoice in our sufferings, because suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope doesn't put us to shame, because the love of God has been shed abroad in our hearts through the Holy Spirit which has been given to us. In the first two verses of this reading, Paul is saying simply that when a sinner approaches God in faith, something happens to him. As we noticed last week, actually, something happens not only to him, but something happens first for him. He's justified. He's given the gift, and Paul calls it a free gift. He's given the gift of his justification. And this free gift is wrapped up in the righteousness of Christ, and it's tied very securely with the promises of God. And it's handed to us as a gift. And on the gift is a card that says, "From one who loves you very much." Now I'll tell you what, that's what's done for you when you approach God in faith. Something is done to you, your sanctification. You began to find inside you, in you, a newborn desire to be like God and to please Him rather than yourself. You began to see it actually taking effect as you, with unveiled face, began to behold the glory of the Lord, or being changed into His very likeness from one degree of glory to another. That's what's done to you. And what's done in you is that you have peace. Being therefore justified, we have peace. You're no longer worried about your past sins. They've been forgiven. It was given you as a gift, this justification. Don't worry about it anymore. And you're confident in the future that if you walk in the light as He is in the light, the blood of Jesus, His Son, cleanses us from all sin. So you have this beautiful peace that covers not only the past, but the future and the present. That's what Paul says is happening to the believer. But in verses 3 through 5, he says something else. He introduces another factor. And this other factor is something really that we'd rather not talk about. We'd rather not experience it, at least. It's like what the writer of Hebrews said in Hebrews 12 and verse 11. He says there that for the moment all discipline seems painful, not pleasant. And what Paul talks about here, we would prefer not to experience. We would even prefer to protect other people from it, people whom we love. Parents often don't want their children to experience these things, and they'll go to any length in order to shield their children from these experiences that I'm going to be talking about. Some of the most agonizing hours of my life overseas as a missionary there was the agonizing hours that were spent waiting on these young Christians to get through some of these struggles and trials. Oh, how I wept for them inside and out, how I was eaten up. They were my babies. And how I wanted to go in and just solve their problems for them, you know, and get the answers for them and tell them this and tell them that and get it all taken care of so they wouldn't have to experience it. But I had to just go home and sit and wait and pray. There was a little boy once that saw a butterfly struggling to get out of its cocoon. And he was alarmed as he saw the little thing just struggling. And he panicked and he went in the house and got a razor blade. And he slit the sides of that cocoon and let the butterfly out. And the butterfly got out much easier. But it couldn't fly. You see, the little boy didn't know that it's in the struggle that the butterfly produces the muscles in its wings that allows it to soar on out into a higher existence than it's had before. And I think that's what Paul is saying here. I think when he says we rejoice in our sufferings, that he's saying it's in this struggle that you develop the muscles by which you soar off into a higher plane of living than you've ever experienced before. And that's why he says we rejoice in it. But you know, this passage is so odd. that I think it takes quite a bit of looking at in order to accept, and perhaps understand and accept. When he says we rejoice in our sufferings, it reminds me of what Tonto said to the Lone Ranger. And if you can make that connection, and you can, listen. Remember when the time that Tonto and the Lone Ranger were surrounded by Indians? All around them, there were just thousands of Indians surrounding Tonto and the Lone Ranger. And the Lone Ranger panicked, and he said, Tonto, what are we going to do? Tonto said, what do you mean, we, Paleface? And when Paul says we rejoice in our suffering, I say, what do you mean, we, Paleface? I don't know whether I rejoice in my sufferings or not. Well, I know what he's talking about, I think. But it's hard to experience it. It's hard to really and truly rejoice. And I think probably Paul is saying that this takes place after it's already over, because no discipline is pleasant while it's going on. But Paul says, or rather the writer of Hebrews says, that this discipline does yield the peaceable fruit of righteousness by those who've been disciplined by it, or by those who've been trained by it. But he talks about this, and we're going to talk about who the we is, and we need to identify. But first of all, let's talk about what the struggles are. What are the sufferings he's talking about? Maybe we can't say for sure, but I suspect the sufferings that he's talking about are those that come immediately after the person's conversion. I think what he's talking about is that having been raised from the waters of baptism to walk this new life, and having been just given this brand new gift of justification through the blood of Christ, I think he's saying then, when you go back home, when you go back and start living this daily life of living for Christ, among those who know you best and often see you at your worst, I think that's part of what he's talking about. Among unchristian parents, among unchristian brothers and unchristian sisters, among people who really don't understand and don't sympathize with your life as a Christian, when you get back there, the struggle really sets in. Oh, the joy of the thought of becoming like God it's amazing. It's all-encompassing, and it just simply thrills you. But then you go back home, and the struggle begins. Or you go back to work, and you meet face-to-face the ungodliness of the fellows with whom you work. You meet their dishonesty. You meet their ungodliness. You meet the dog-to-dog or dog-eat-dog pressures of day-to-day working. And there you're thrown right back in the lion's den, and there those pressures get after you. I think that's what he's talking about. I think he's talking about getting back into the world in general, when the Christian has accomplished the battle in himself now initially. And now he gets up off his knees, he gets up and is raised up out of the waters of baptism and goes back into the world to begin living among the world. We're not of it, but we're in it. And this in it, but not of it, battle is what Paul is referring to here. These sufferings, he says, are essential to your becoming a full, mature Christian. It may be that he's saying that when you go back on the school campus, you know there's enough ungodliness on the Harding campus that it's going to find you. If you lived like that before you became a Christian, don't think they're going to just say, oh, he's a Christian now. No, they're going to come after you. They're going to come get you. And what you're doing then, when you get back on the campus and you're tempted then to go back to your whatever you were doing before, and then you finally, and you go back home and you go back to work and you go back into the world, you hit the ground with a thud as you start living the daily life for Christ. You try, just like that butterfly trying to get out of that cocoon. And oh, you struggle trying to get away from your former environment, trying to get out there on a higher plane of living. And what a struggle it is. But you know, Paul says we rejoice in that too. We're glad for that too. And what he's saying essentially is this, and I'm not going to deal with what he's talking about here as far as the process. The process is this. He says that these struggles produce steadfastness, this hupomone, this ability to remain under with your shoulder to the wheel. That's what he says, that these temptations and trials and sufferings produce this. And then he says that this steadfastness produces this character. And then he says, as a result of this thing of every victory becoming a stepping stone to the next plateau of character, and then he says the character begins to produce hope in us. You know that, by the way, I think maybe by the grace of God I'm going to make it after all. And then he says that the one concrete thing that God has given you by which you can know that you have been justified and that you do have this relationship with God is that you began to see in you this desire for other people, your love for them. He says this hope does not put us to shame because the love of God has been shed abroad in our hearts. Love for people in spite of what they are and love for God because of what He is. That's what he's talking about. He said, that's why we rejoice in these sufferings, because it's because of the sufferings that we experience the patience or the steadfastness and then the character and then the hope and the love. The hope doesn't put to shame because the love of God's been shed abroad in our hearts. And that's why he says we rejoice in it. What he's saying essentially is that we rejoice in these struggles, just like the butterfly. It was necessary for him to go through the struggle to get out of that cocoon. He says that for you Christians, you young people and old alike, it's necessary for you to go through these struggles in order to grow out of your former environment and come into a fuller, richer life on a higher plane. He says it's one of those necessary things. But I want you to notice something. I want you to notice that he talks about it's for a peculiar class of people. And we come now to the we, or this who it is that he says does rejoice. And who it is that is finding in himself these things produced of steadfastness and character and hope and love. He says there's a peculiar class of people that this is true of. And it's simply the fact that the person who is a believer, he's the one that Paul says here, is the one that rejoices in his sufferings. It's the believer in whose life we find steadfastness developing. It's the believer in whose life hope comes. It's the believer in whose life love is showing up. These things, he says, happen in our lives, yes. But he said, and we've got to go back to the we. Unless you go back and pick up who the we is, this doesn't make sense. Because the ordinary person who is not a believer in God, pressures aren't a pleasure for him. Pressures aren't something that he enjoys. He doesn't rejoice in any pressures. He doesn't rejoice in any sufferings. The person that doesn't believe in God is a person upon whom pressures and rather the strain and the struggle and the persecutions and the sufferings of life upon whom they come, they produce a callous on that person if he doesn't believe in God. It produces a sour, disgruntled spirit that lashes out at teachers and lashes out at the elders and lashes out at parents. You think somebody's always got it in for you and you're not getting a fair shake. You know why? You may ought to check yourself to see whether or not you really believe in God. Because Paul states here unequivocally, he states that the believer in God rejoices in his sufferings. But let me say this, it is the believer. It's the believer. For example, it's because we believe that the pressures of life began to disappear. The pressures of life began to disappear. Because we believe in God. And I mean here primarily pressures of our peer group. The more I think about it, young people, the more I'm convinced that not just with you, but with every people, every age group, every strata of society, it's this pressure that comes from our peer group, our wanting to be like the people round about us with whom we have associations. It's this that's the greatest pressure that's ever brought to bear on a Christian, young or old. We like to be liked. Don't you? I do. And the only way you're going to ever escape from the pressures of life is to come to before God with a faith that's strong enough that says, I want to be your friend more than I want to be your friend. And that's why I stand here in this pulpit without any pressure. I'm not under any pressure up here. I told my brother-in-law this the other day. He's vice president of York College. I said, I'm not under any pressure. He said, well, I was worried about you. I could have told him I didn't have enough sense to be under any pressure. That's probably part of it. But that's not the real part of it. The real reason is that I'm wanting to be, and I say this not with any bragging, I settled this thing 20 years ago. I determined 20 years ago that I was going to preach for God and to people. And when it comes right down to it, I don't care whether you like what I say or not. If you want me to be real frank, I don't care whether you like it or not. And yet I spend many hours a week preparing so that you will, in a sense, like what I say. But the only reason I want you to like it is because I want you to stay awake so you can hear what I say so it'll do you some good. As far as it tickling your ears, I couldn't care less. I made up my mind a long time ago that if I'm going to preach, I'm going to please God, and if you don't like it, then lump it. And that's about as simple as I can put it. My only concern with standing here before you, whether you're students or professors or who you may be, my only concern with you is whether or not you can bear it and understand it and profit from it. And there are a lot of things I would say in a different way if I thought you could get it and understand it and grow from it. I'd say it in a different way. There are a lot of things that I would say sooner, and I've held back on it until I could prepare your hearts to where I think you're able to hear what I'm going to say later. And 3 or 4 weeks later, I'm going to say some things that may just literally burn your ears today. But I'm going to put it off for a while. But I'm not under any pressure by standing in this pulpit, and I thank God. And I pray more than anything else, I pray God help me realize who I'm preaching for and help me realize who I'm preaching to. And that always clears the air for me. What'll clear the air for you? The same thing. Who do you want to be friends with? Paul said in Galatians 1:10, he says, am I still trying to court the favor of men or God? He says, am I trying to please men? He said, if I were still trying to please men, I wouldn't be a servant of Christ. But he indicates that there's got to be a decision made. You've got to decide who it is that whom it is you're going to please. You've got to decide who you want to be friends with more, God or people. And once you've made that decision, but it only comes to the believer. But the believer in God knows the kind of person God is. And he knows that he's trustworthy. You know your associations are going to fail. Your friendships are going to wax and wane. And I listened to a little girl last night talk about how friendships go and come and how that it leaves you kind of, not knowing what to do. But the writer of Hebrews said that this friendship with God is one that's stable. He says, God has promised, I'll never forsake you. I will not fail you, neither will I in any wise forsake you. So the writer says, we can with confidence say, I will not fear. What can man do to me? And that's why Paul told the Philippian brethren, don't be anxious in anything. But by prayer and supplication, let your request be made known to God, and the peace of God that passes all understanding shall guard your heart and your thoughts in Christ Jesus. That's why Peter said, cast all your anxieties upon him, because he cares about you. And it's this kind of a friendship. It's the believer in God who comes to God, believing that things are going to be just exactly like God said they'll be, and believing that God is able to do as he's promised. It's that kind of person that comes like Abraham, believing in a God who is invisible and can accomplish the incredible or the impossible and can do the incredible. This kind of a belief in that kind of a God causes you to want to be friends with him rather than just friends with people. And listen, friendship with the world is enmity with God. And I think he points here to the very center and core of all of our problems, wanting to be or to have the approval of the people round about us rather than the approval of God. So I say that whenever we come as a believer in God, the pressures of life really do, they just fade away. But something else happens. When you come to God in faith, it is the believer to whom the things of life really become really unimportant. The pressures of life begin to fade away. The things in life begin to lose their appeal. Because Jesus said, and we believe what he said, that a man's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that he possesses. That's in Luke, the 12th chapter in verse 15. That a man's life does not consist in the abundance of things that he possesses. You know, I believe that. Do you? Consequently, Jesus said, what shall a man be profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Matthew 16:26. What shall a man be profited if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And Paul reminded Timothy of something that's very, very pointed. He says, for after all, we didn't bring anything into the world, and you're not going to take anything out. So having food and clothing, let's therewith be content. Now let me show you what this will do. This will help you stop this insatiable, never-ending attempt to feed a filet mignon appetite on a baloney budget. And that's what a lot of us spend our time doing. And consequently, we're always burdened down with all these weights of bills and bills and bills for what we need and all just because of what we want. God will give you what you need if you'll follow him. Jesus said, seek first the kingdom of heaven. And all these things, he talked about food and clothing and covering. He said, all these things will be added to you as well. But when a person comes to God in faith, believing that a man's life doesn't consist in the abundance of things that he possesses, and believing that if he were to gain the whole world and lose his own soul, he would have lost everything, well, that person then learns that the things of life really come to be of no meaning except as a means to an end. They never become an end in themselves. The third thing that happens, the hurts in life, the injuries began to heal. You learn to forgive people. How many of you are carrying a grudge in your heart against somebody right now? Have you forgiven them? And listen, this applies to old folks as well as young. You know there are older people here in the audience who have grudges against others. Have you forgiven those grudges? Have you forgotten them? Have you gotten them out? You may never be able to forget them, but have you forgiven them to the point that you can operate now and there's no anxiety, there's no chewing, there's no knot in your stomach whenever you think about the person? What about it? Believing in God will cause you to be able to forgive your brother. Jesus says that we ought to love our enemies and pray for those that persecute us. Well, you can't do that unless you believe in God who has given you a gift that's 10 million times greater than the gift that, or the debt that, is owed to you by somebody else. When you think about all the things that God has forgiven you and this package that he gave you with his name written on it, you know, and from someone that loves you, this gift that he's given to you, in Matthew, the 18th chapter, he says you dare not accept that gift and then go out and extract from your brother the blood that he owes you. You better forgive him too, or else you're going to be called in by the judge of the universe and it's going to be taken away from you and you're going to be thrown into prison until you've paid the last penny. The believer in God believes that he's going to do what he says he'll do. You better forgive him. You better forgive your neighbor. You better love your neighbor and your enemy too. And the believer in God does. And he's lifted, or there's lifted up off his shoulders this tremendous burden of the grudges that we often carry and the weight of animosity that we often harbor in our hearts. So the believer, the pressures of life began to just disappear. The things of life began to lose their appeal. The injuries of life began to heal. And then the end of life, death, loses its sting because we believe. A nurse once told me, she said, I have watched people who are not Christians and who have no hope. I have watched them hold on to the bed in the hospitals and cry and scream and beg, please don't let me die. The sting of death was being felt. But then there are other Christians. The mothers of many of us and the fathers have died or just recently or a long time ago. But then the Christian dies. And there's the peace and the resolution that you're in the hand of the one who is the resurrection and the life. There's no sting there. Do you fear dying? I say I don't. I don't think I do. It may change when I'm faced with it. But I never think about it. I envy some older people who are nearer crossing the river than I am, perhaps by natural causes. The believer in God, for him the sting of death has been removed. For Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He that comes to me, or he that believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live again. And it's this that Paul mentions in 1 Thessalonians, when he says there that I would not have you ignorant, brethren, concerning those who have fallen asleep, concerning those who've died, that we sorrow not like the rest who don't have any hope. For since we believe that Jesus died and rose again from the dead, even so shall God bring with him those who have fallen asleep. That's what he says. And he says that we don't have to sorrow. We don't sorrow because we believe that God will do as he's promised. That he will not only raise up Jesus Christ as he has, but he will also bring those who have already died with him when he comes and we meet him in the air. And let me say this. That all of this that I'm talking about, this thing about not having to go out and always be wanting something, you know, that you can't afford. And this thing about the pressures of life where you find yourself under such tremendous tension to be liked by other people. And when these injuries and all, you know, that come at you and they just simply smother you, when I talk about being freed from all these things and freed from the thing of death, I'm not talking about that kind of enjoyment and that kind of rejoicing that says I'm going to rejoice in this if it kills me. That's not it. Neither is it the kind that this man told his wife, she said, I've told you 100 times to be happy. That's not it. Neither is it the kind when I saw this cartoon of a man and his wife out under a pup tent in the woods, sleeping, or there, they were out there supposed to be sleeping, and it was just pouring down rain. And she was sitting there with it dripping off her nose saying, "Tell me again how much fun we're having." That's not the kind that Paul talks about here. He's talking about a genuine belief in God that what is in store for the believer is good because all things work together for good to those that love the Lord. He's talking about that genuine faith that literally takes hold and captivates you and makes you do something simply because of the fact that you believe something. And this is even greater because of the fact that it makes us do something and feel something and be something because of not what we believe, but in whom we believe. There's the key. We believe in God. And He's the God that will do exactly as He said He will do. He's the God that's able to do according as He's promised. He's the God that's able to make happen to us all things that are good for our good to those that love the Lord. This is the kind of God, and this is what happens to you. And when I say you're freed then from the anxieties, that's exactly what happens. You just don't have them anymore. When you're freed from the lust and the longing of to be like the world and to have the things of the world, you won't have that anymore. When I say you're freed from the hurt and the anxiety that comes from people persecuting you and your sufferings that you take from their hurts, you don't have that anymore. You've forgiven them. And when I say you approach death with your eye on the Lord, the one that has the keys of death, and you approach it peacefully, that's what happens. Now, young people, this is some of the bread of Christianity. You know, someone said, we need to be eating the bread and not just the recipe. And there's a lot in that that's true. What is your Christianity doing for you? Are you just trying to content yourself on eating the recipe? Or are you enjoying the bread? And you know, if you just eat the recipe until you just gorge yourself and paper starts running out your ears and the ink and all, you could just, and they, how are you feeling? Feeling great? Are you hungry? Man, no, look here. Well, you can get filled up on a recipe. But I'll tell you one thing, it's going to take the bread of life if you ever get through this life successfully. And what I'm saying to you this morning is some of the bread. Are you eating it? We rejoice in our sufferings. Because suffering produces patience or steadfastness. Steadfastness produces character. Character produces hope. And this hope doesn't put us to shame because the love of God has been shed abroad in your life, in your heart, through the Holy Spirit which has been given us. And in this way, Paul says, we rejoice in our sufferings. You know, the Christian life is the most beautiful. It is the most perfectly rounded thing on the face of God's earth. I never have seen anything like it. And this, Romans, the fifth chapter, first five verses, they are part of this great, rounded, beautiful revelation from God. This is what life's all about. Have you been justified? If you haven't, you need to come and surrender yourself in faith. If you believe in God that much, that you'll surrender yourself to Him in faith, submit yourself to Him in this act of baptism whereby you commit yourself to Him, from which you'll come forth raised to walk a new life, then begin to eat the bread, begin to enjoy the benefits of trusting in God that it'll be just exactly like He says it will be, and heaven is waiting on you. It's almost immediate. And it'll be all the way through your life, and then you'll have it eternally.